Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. While we may be most familiar with the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, there have been exactly five mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth, catastrophic periods where biological diversity and the sheer number of living organisms on the planet were reduced by staggering proportions. In a new book called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker asks whether we are right now living in the midst of another mass extinction, one caused not by an asteroid or an ice age, but by us, the human race. Elizabeth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to throw this out there. This book didn't exactly make me feel very great about the human race.
I think that one of the points that I do try to make, and you can make of this what you will, is that a lot of our best qualities, our creativity, our inventiveness, you know, our interest in other people, and even our interest in the world, our restlessness, are tied to the ways that we're impacting the world and causing this mass extinction event. So you could say that that's happy, or you could say that that's unhappy. I'm gonna leave it to you. How's that?
Okay. Well, like I said, unfortunately, I guess I took the cynical view.
Okay. Okay.
So I was born into a world where many endangered animals were and are the norm. So I sort of grew up thinking that I guess that extinction is in some way a natural part of evolution. But you write that throughout most of history, it's actually extremely rare.
Yes, that is. I'm glad you brought that up because that is really one of the main points of the book. It's a very simple one. We are so inured to extinction. We read about it all the time that we just say, "Oh, that's, you know, just part of the way things are." And I've had people say to me, you know, point blank, "Oh, isn't this just the sort of the natural order?" And the important thing to realize is that extinction in the natural order, so, you know, understood over vast periods of time, the whole history of life, is actually extremely rare. It's got to be rarer when you think about it. It's got to be rarer than speciation. Then we see new species created, and we don't see new species popping up all the time.
Sort of like the birth rate is generally higher than the death rate.
Exactly. Otherwise, the planet would be depopulated, right? I mean, these are pretty basic mathematical concepts.
So what is the extinction rate now, and how does that compare to the sort of quote-unquote pre-Homo sapiens average?
Yeah, well, it's hundreds, perhaps thousands of times what scientists refer to as the background rate, and that background rate is different for different groups of organisms, and it's usually calculated just by going through vast databases of fossils and trying to figure out how long the average species lives. So, you know, in the case of let's say a mammal, you know, that might be a few million years that the average species tends to live. And we see now, as I say, extinction rates that are hundreds, perhaps thousands, perhaps in some groups even tens of thousands of times higher than they seem to be in the fossil record. And, you know, those are only unfortunately increasing.
So before we get, I guess, to this concept of the sixth extinction, I wanted to go back and look at the big five mass extinctions thus far. I said in the intro, most of us have sort of a basic impression about that great big asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. But what about those other four? What are the stories behind those?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, we're talking about events that happened tens, hundreds of millions of years ago. So they're sort of, you know, murder mystery cases with a very, very cold trail. But the first of these major mass extinctions was about 440 million years ago. And interestingly enough, that is the time when life was still really confined to the water. So that was a really devastating event for aquatic life, but not for terrestrial life, because there simply was no life on land. And it's seems pretty clear that that was caused by this weird cold event, a very sudden glaciation event that is hard to explain, but the world got a lot colder pretty quickly right at that moment. The most devastating of all of these events was what's known as the end Permian extinction, and that occurred about 250 million years ago. And there's a book that's been written about that extinction by a British paleontologist, and it's called When Life Nearly Died. It got very, very close, perilously close, to eliminating multicellular life altogether. So that was a really devastating event. And that seems to have been caused, and this is where some very, very frightening parallels occur to one, by a really massive outflux of carbon dioxide.
Well, I guess that makes me ask, you know, how do we this sixth extinction compared to, say, an asteroid or, you know, a glacial event?
Well, I guess the honest answer to that would be we're not exactly sure. But people are very interested right now, particularly in this and Permian extinction, precisely because there seem to be some pretty scary parallels here. When you emit lots of carbon dioxide really fast, as we're doing and as happened at the end of the Permian period, a couple things happen. First of all, as you say, you raise global temperatures because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so that just follows pretty naturally, you know, despite what some people would say about the debate over climate change. That's just really a pretty basic geophysical fact. So you got massive global warming at the end of the Permian. And also you get a phenomenon that's also sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, which is a lot of CO2 dissolves in the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. And it's a weak acid. You know, you drink it when you drink a Coke, that's carbonated water. But
we all know what happens if you drink too much Coke.
Exactly. And if you pour enough of it, into the water, you change the water, the chemistry of the water, and that's happening. That's measurable. That's observable. That's, you know, not debatable either. And at the end of the Permian period, you also got this massive event of what's become known as ocean acidification, and we are seeing ocean acidification now, and that's another parallel that's not a very happy parallel.
Pretty cheery stuff here. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Now, I feel like I have to ask this for the sake of argument, but aren't Homo sapiens a quote-unquote sort of natural part of the world? And, you know, no matter how many species we are directly or indirectly responsible for their extinction, isn't that too, in effect, I guess, a natural part of life and death on Earth?
I think that, you know, becomes kind of a semantic question, I suppose. I mean, is an asteroid natural? You know, yeah, it didn't have any... It's not supernatural. How's that? So to the extent that, you know, we are organic beings, or the asteroid wasn't even an organic being, but, you know, to the extent that we're part of this ecosystem that's the planet, we depend on it, yeah, we're natural. But, you know, I'm not sure that really makes any difference at the end of the day. And in some ways, it's only all the more sobering because, you know, we are dependent on this system. We are very much implicated in the natural world, whether we choose to believe that or not. So when you set really massive changes in motion, you know, to your own home planet, you kind of have to be wondering, you know, where that's going to lead.
Well, I guess that same argument would say that if there was an extinction of the human race, that was also natural, which is not something we're probably too fond of thinking about.
Exactly.
So if this sixth extinction is already taking place, what kind of efforts are underway to catalog and archive species before they disappear, given that it sounds like for many of them, the damage has already been done?
Well, there are lots and lots of efforts going on. I mean, there are these, for example, just to give you one kind of effort that's going on, there are these like rapid assessment teams that go out into pretty remote parts of the world and try to catalog absolutely everything that's there, precisely with this idea of, well, who knows if we come back in 20 years, you know, what's going to be here. So that's, you know, just one effort. But there are massive efforts going on in all ecosystems, all parts of the world, really, to catalog what's there. But, you know, the problem is that it's a very, very time-consuming work and very, very specialized work. And there are a lot of species out there. We do not know how many species we share this planet with, you know, really even to an order of magnitude, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, you write about one kind of weird effort, I guess, freezing animals, like in sort of like Ted Williams' Head.
Yeah, exactly. That was a really interesting trip. I went out to San Diego to something called the Frozen Zoo, which, you know, sounds like a zoo, but really it's not the kind of zoo you'd really want to visit. And what it really is just a bunch of vats of liquid nitrogen. And in these vats are cell lines, right? So we can get cells to grow, you know, in a petri dish, basically, and then freeze them, put them into sort of a state of suspended animation. And some very, very highly endangered animals, and in one case, the cells of an animal that is now extinct are now, you know, and I use this term in quotes, living on in these vats of liquid nitrogen.
Scientists in Russia have talked about cloning a woolly mammoth. I was reading about this morning. Just one of several examples of a movement towards something called de-extinction. With all those still living species now on the endangered list, doesn't that seem a little odd to you?
Well, I think de-extinction is one of those ideas that really captures the public's imagination.
Yeah, but who doesn't want to see a woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, count me in, you know, and when the woolly mammoth shows up, I'm going to be first to buy a ticket.
Oh, we can go together.
Okay, great. Yeah. But I do want to say that there are, you know, when you start to really look at the idea in any kind of rigorous ways, there are huge obstacles, both just technically, you know, we don't have any woolly mammoth cells around. We don't have any woolly mammoth, for example, in the frozen zoo. So you have to genetically engineer a woolly mammoth cell. And right now we are not capable of doing that. Then you've got to get, you know, that to become an embryo. You've got to get some other animal to carry it to term, right? Woolly mammoths don't just come full blown into the world. They have, you know, very long gestation periods. And then let's say you even overcame all of those hurdles. The point is made that animals are more than their genome, right? So like if you raised a human, if you could create a human, there were no more humans, you created a human baby, you know, that baby wouldn't really be human if it was raised in a tank. And ditto for that woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths, you know, presumably had very sophisticated societies, just like elephants, and they had to learn a lot from their social group members. So, you know, what do you have when you have one member of a species? It's kind of a creepy thought.
Wow. Well, like I said, it's a tough conversation. Is it sort of too late to turn the tide?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to always see things in these stark terms, like, okay, either all hope is lost or you know, everything's going to be fine. And I think, unfortunately, the truth is very much in the middle. It's not too late for, you know, pretty much everything that's still out there. It's obviously too late for those things, you know, that aren't out there anymore, of which there are, unfortunately, an increasing number every week, practically. But we're talking about turning a battleship, you know, that's headed in one direction right now. You know, you could argue that we're really sort of maximizing our impacts on the planet. We're changing the atmosphere. We're changing the chemistry of the ocean. We're moving things around that often in ways that often have devastating effects. We're, you know, mowing down the rainforest. So we're really doing all the things that on some level we know we shouldn't be doing. And we're probably doing a bunch of things, you know, that we don't even not even aware of the impacts that they're having. So we really need to do, you know, we'll be working on a lot of different levels to try to minimize our impacts. So I think a lot of damage has been done. A lot of damage is probably close to inevitable at this point, but a lot of damage is not close to inevitable at this point, and that is a choice that we still have to make.
Elizabeth Culbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Up next on Word of Mouth, we kick off NHPR's series on higher ed, A Matter of Degrees, with the story of a cash-strapped student who set out to pay his tuition and wound up raising $1 million on one absolutely hideous website. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth. This week, NHPR is investigating all aspects of higher education in its series, A Matter of Degrees. And our next story from the podcast TLDR tackles an increasingly difficult issue on college campuses, tuition costs. While most students take out loans or take on part-time work to fund their education, Alex, too, chipped away at the cost a very different way, one pixel at a time.
To hear Alex, too, tell it, he's always had an entrepreneurial spirit.
I mean, I started my first entrepreneurial venture when I was like 7 or 8 years old, trying to sell comics that I drew at home and then get them photocopied down the road and sell them to my classmates. And I think I sold about 4 comics.
At boarding school, he sold contraband candy. In the 90s, he toyed with the idea of a 900 number that you could call if you wanted to just listen to human laughter.
And the idea is it would be infectious and cheer you up. you know, just like a terrible idea, but sometimes terrible ideas can be so terrible or silly that they work.
Alex's terrible, silly idea that worked came to him in 2005. He was living at his parents' house a month away from starting college, and every night before bed, he would force himself to brainstorm.
And I wrote down this question, how could I become a millionaire before I go to college?
Alex was 21. He didn't have anything to sell, or nothing of value anyway.
Eventually arrived in this idea of, well, I could sell a million pixels for a dollar each, right? And it was really that kind of simple. And I thought, well, okay, I'll put them all on one page and the million-dollar homepage. And, you know, it's so stupid, it might work.
So that was the idea. Sell pixels on a web page at a dollar each in 10 by 10 blocks. Buyers could then place tiny images to link to their own websites. 10,000 of these 10 by 10 blocks were available, so if it worked, it would be total visual chaos, an infinitely cluttered billboard, like Times Square squeezed onto a postage stamp. It only took Alex a couple days to get the site together, and then he begged friends and family to buy $1,000 worth of space, 1/1,000th of the page, just so it didn't look completely empty at launch.
And then I used that money to pay for a press release to go out to the world, which I wrote myself. And it was just, you know, along the lines of student trying to become a millionaire by selling pixels. It's just this stupid story.
Some people think a computer keyboard makes a clicking sound. Others hear the sound of money. Alex Tu, an impoverished 21-year-old college student, heard a lot of money.
The Guardian, the BBC News Online, and the UK tech site The Register all picked up the story in the same day.
And on that day when those articles came out, like, suddenly I made $3,000. And then as soon as it made some money, it started getting more attention. And then as it got more attention, it started making more money because the page started to have value.
Alex was learning something that seems kind of obvious today, but wasn't exactly obvious in 2005. Internet attention runs on a feedback loop. People pay attention to things that people are paying attention to. And that can be valuable. As the money poured in, so did the copycats. There was a million penny homepage, a million euro homepage. There was a million-dollar Mona Lisa, where all the ads would create a photo mosaic of the Da Vinci painting. None of them did nearly as well as the million-dollar homepage.
But I think the copycats helped because it just added to the whole kind of phenomenon, if you like, and it just helped elevate the original even more.
It only took 4 months for Alex to reach his million-dollar goal. The site was plastered with ugly ads for flash games, porn, for Jesus, online poker, even something called the Book of Cool. He entered his first semester of college as a very rich, minor internet celebrity, in an era before the internet really had celebrities. But now he had a new problem, the sophomore slump.
You know, I struggled to think about what to do after the million-dollar homepage. It was kind of like the difficult second album. At the time, I was full of confidence. I was like, yeah, this is awesome. I could do this again. And people saying, oh, you're a genius. And I was like, oh, maybe I am. You know, that was my primary mindset for the months following it. But that mindset quickly changed when I realized actually the chance of doing it again is very slim because I really know nothing about building a real business.
Instead of building a real business, Alex tried a scheme that looked very similar to the million-dollar homepage. It was called Pixelato. It was the same concept, except this time around, instead of charging a dollar a pixel, Alex charged two, and the idea was that once he sold all the space, some lucky visitor would click on the page and win $1 million, as well as $100,000 to be contributed to their favorite charity. But unlike the million-dollar homepage, Pixelato only sold just over 1/10 of its ad space.
Confidence changed to self-doubt and criticism pretty quickly. And then you realize actually it takes years and years to build up experience and to meet great people and to find people to teach you and mentor you. And I certainly still believe in that principle, that one idea can change your life. I really do believe that. But I think that it's often much more complex and much more challenging to bring ideas into the world, whatever they are.
Over the years, Alex has run at a lot of big ideas. There was Sock and Awe, a web game where you could throw a shoe at George Bush. Pop Jam, a picture-sharing site for funny memes. And 1 Million People, which was really just the million-dollar homepage, but with tiny pictures of people. Most recently, Alex has pivoted away from the get-rich-relatively-quick schemes entirely. Instead, he's doing something less nakedly entrepreneurial.
When you're much younger, you know, I think you have different motivations. And, you know, I was living at home with my parents. You know, I was 21 and I had no money, no car. It's kind of broke, right? And so the idea of making tons of money seemed very appealing. And it, you know, it is appealing relative to having no money. But it was more of a priority then than it is now. And I see money more as a means to do great stuff as opposed to an end in itself, right?
That's the line of thinking that led Alex to his latest project. It's called calm.com. That's calm.com.
The idea is to bring meditation to the world through the web and through mobile. And meditation has certainly made a very positive impact on my life. And, you know, I want to bring those benefits to millions of people who could also benefit.
It's a website and app that allows you to choose nature scenes, play relaxing New Age music, and if you so choose, walks you through guided meditation. Maybe it'll succeed, maybe it won't. But it's hard to imagine that it'll do what I suspect Alex would like it to do, which is to supplant inventor of the $1 million homepage as the first line of his obituary. Meanwhile, the $1 million homepage still lives online. But as of today, more than one-fifth of the links that populated are dead. Almost $250,000 worth of advertising. Leading nowhere.
That's the podcast TLDR, in case you're wondering. That stands for Too Long Didn't Read. Word of mouth continues with the question so many parents dread. Mom, Dad, why is the sky blue? Fear not, we have the answer and more on how to communicate complicated scientific concepts simply, efficiently, and accurately when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In his first book, Bad Astronomy, author Phil Plait wrote a joke about how to explain to inquiring children why the sky is blue.
You look him or her right in the eye and say, it's because of quantum effects involving Rayleigh scattering combined with the lack of violet photon receptors in our retinae.
Of course, this explanation is way too advanced for most kids, and yet, the out-of-context quote has since been memefied and passed around the web like an inspirational cat poster. Phil Plait is now the man behind the Bad Astronomy blog at Slate, and he joins us now to correct the record and offer a slightly simpler explanation. Phil Plait, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So in the same chapter, you actually do give a simpler version of why the sky is blue. So how would you suggest explaining that concept to a curious child?
Well, it depends, of course, on the age of the kid. If they're very, very young, that might be difficult on any level to explain. But as they get older and they start to appreciate analogies, you can compare one thing to another thing. And you can say that, for example, the light coming from the sun is like a tree. And if things fall from the tree, like leaves, they get blown around and scatter around and wind up falling all over the yard. But something like a nut or a fruit falls straight down. And that's the analogy. And you say the red light from the sun is like that fruit. It comes right to your eye. But the blue light is like the leaves. And the air in the sky scatters it around, and you wind up seeing it all over the sky. It's not the best analogy. No analogy is ever perfect. But it might give them a little bit of a head start for when they learn about the actual scientific underpinnings of this phenomenon.
Well, yeah, that is something I kind of wonder. There must be something to be said for giving kids the hard-to-understand straight answer in hopes that either they do pick up on it or maybe they seek out the knowledge they need to understand it even better.
Yeah, and you know, it's always going to be a decision by the parent. You want to say, well, some light from the sun goes straight to your eye and some light gets binged around like a ping pong ball or whatever. You can give it a more straight description. You can use analogies, models, or you can, you know, it's okay to sometimes say, you know, that's actually really tough to explain. And at the end of the book chapter, I actually say this, that, you know, look, this is a hard concept. It seems simple. The sky is blue. There it is. Look up. And yet, the scientific basis of this is actually fairly complicated. And for a long time, people didn't understand it. And they had the wherewithal to say, you know what? I don't get this. I don't understand it. Let me see why this happened. And they figured it out. And that's really the most important part about science. When, you know, kids love the idea of being able to figure stuff out. So you tell them, hey, that, you know, that's what science is.
So I read that according to a British survey that was conducted in 2012, that the color of the sky is one of the questions that many, many kids ask their parents about. Another one was, how much does the Earth weigh? Which, as you know, is it technically weighs nothing. It's orbiting the sun. But would you suggest tackling a question like this that could be answered in kind of a few different ways?
Well, yeah, there's a difference between mass and weight, and that's the sort of the crux of this, and that is something has mass, and that just means that it's made of matter, and if you push on it, it's hard to push on. The more matter it has in it, the more it resists getting pushed. Now, if you stick something like that in a gravity field, if you let it sit on the surface of the Earth, it has weight, and that's a force. If you go into space, things are weightless, but they still have mass, and so something like a big heavy piece of equipment that an astronaut's trying to install on the space station, they might be able to push on it, and it will move very slowly at first. But if they keep pushing on it, it will keep moving. It has mass, but not weight. So you could kind of say, hey, if we could put the Earth on a scale, and, you know, if it were sitting on the surface of another Earth, then sitting on the scale, it would weigh 6.6 sextillion tons, I think is the weight of it. But actually, because it's orbiting the sun, it's weightless. It's in free fall.
Okay, I've got a good one for you, Phil. Did you ever read Calvin and Hobbes?
All the time. Are you kidding?
Okay, yeah, me too. I was a big fan. And there was a strip that I'll never forget. It was one of my favorite ones where Calvin asks his dad where wind comes from, and his dad says that it's trees sneezing. And Calvin says, he says, really? Or I don't believe you, or something like that. And his dad says, no, but the truth is more complicated. In this case, how might you have answered Calvin's question?
Well, I always, when a kid asks me something like that, I always like to take a second. You know, you don't always have the answers at the tip of your tongue, just like I don't right now. So I'm just saying a bunch of words to you to give my other part of my brain a moment to think about it. And you can say, well, you can't see the air, but you know it's there. When you run, you feel it on your face. When you're on a bicycle, you can feel it pushing against you. And if you're in a car and you stick your hand out the window, it's quite strong. And it turns out air can move, and that's all wind is. You know, why air moves, well, that's a little bit different. And you can, you know, a lot of kids, if you ask them, what happens when you put hot air into a balloon? And they'll say the balloon gets bigger, and it goes up. And you can say, yeah, that's exactly right. And when you heat up air, it gets bigger, and it moves over to where the cold air is, and that's what creates wind. And that's probably about 30% accurate, but it's a good place to start. And you know what? Let me add, a great thing about this is you can always say, I don't know, or I think it's because of this, let's go find out. And then you can look it up. You can go online or try to find some sort of source that you trust. And a lot of parents want to think that, you know, I should just be able to answer all my kids' questions. And the truth, that never happens. You can't answer everything. So go and find out. And that's, I think, the best thing to teach a kid, that science is a way of finding things out.
Yeah, it's funny. These days you can sort of Google just about anything and get an answer pretty quickly. Do you ever worry that maybe our ability to, you know, check a Wikipedia page or something means that we don't dig in? You know, you don't go to the library. You don't get the book. You don't dig into the science maybe as deeply as you would have before. Or is it a great thing that it's, you know, at your fingertips virtually all the time?
Well, like most things with the internet, it's both. It's great that you can find an answer, but you have to be aware that that answer may not be correct. I see mistakes on Wikipedia, not often, but sometimes. When it's a controversial topic, of course, you're going to get opinions from people. So that's good. You know, you can find some information, but you should be aware that it might be wrong, or it might not really be the information you're looking for. You know, I imagine now if somebody were to look up why the sky is blue, they're going to find that meme with this hugely overly complicated explanation that I gave. And let me point out, you know, that was written as a joke. It was supposed to be a joke. And a lot of the people spreading that around the internet understand it's a joke, but a lot of other people don't. And they're saying, oh, my God, what a jerk. He's not making this explanation simple for kids at all. And it's like, yes, I know. In the book, I then explain it more simply and say, go out and figure this out. Always think critically. Always ask, is this right? Does this make sense? Is there another way I can think of this? And that will lead you, if not to the truth, at least to a better perspective and hopefully a better understanding.
Phil Plait is an astronomer, author, and the blogger behind Slate's Bad Astronomy blog. Phil, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. This was fun.
April was National Poetry Month, and all month long we've asked you to send us your public radio-inspired haikus. We were so impressed with your submissions and felt some of them were just begging to be recited, so we did. Check it out.
I can't spell your name, but I know your voice so well. Oh, great Kai Rizdal.
Soft voice, deep wisdom. She is a vessel. God speaks through Krista Tippett.
Terry Gross, you are not gross. You are more of a Terry Wonderful.
Baby in the car, chanting the toll-free number, making pledge time fun.
I never realized how much I was listening, all things considered.
Breath bated, I hear Ira Glass. Man of my dreams, never stop talking.
Thanks to everyone for your submissions. You can find them all on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And did we miss any of your favorite public radio shows or personalities? If so, feel free to add yours to the collection. Now that I think of it, I don't think I heard Click and Clack in there. Surely Car Talk deserves their own haiku. Here, let's see. Don't mess with my car. Please don't drive like my brother. We want more Car Talk. That was 575. Okay, that works. But it wasn't a very good one, so send us yours. We're at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or you can tweet it to us at wordofmouth. And coming up, Word of Mouth heads back to the classroom. Today's lesson, Coaching 101, what professors can learn from observing collegiate coaches. First, a short timeout.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. It's halftime during the biggest game of your life. Your team has fallen behind, and the significance of this moment cannot be underestimated. Your pride, your personal relationships, a championship, and maybe a scholarship are all on the line. But spirits are low in the locker room until the coach steps in and says something like,
"We got to go out there and we got to take it.
Take control of this game.
It's your time.
This is our time.
This is your time.
You understand me?
Do you understand me?
Yes, coach.
We shut them down.
We do not back down ever.
That's going to make the f***ing difference between winning and losing. Between living and dying.
Of course, winning a game is never as easy as Hollywood makes it sound, and good coaches invest less time in yelling than they do in strategy and real-world problem-solving. Craig Owens is an associate professor of English at Drake University and co-creator of a program that brings academics into the locker room, appropriately called Coaching in the Classroom. We asked him here as part of our week-long station-wide series on higher education, A Matter of Degrees. Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
So does that montage of movie speeches more or less represent what you thought coaching was all about before you actually stepped inside a locker room?
I'm not sure I would say that that's what I thought it was about, but that was certainly the dominant image in my mind, the dominant soundscape. So apart from those kinds of film clips and television clips, I didn't have a very clear idea of what actually went on in varsity locker rooms.
You were more of a theater kid growing up than you were a sports guy.
That's right, yeah.
So what changed? What brought you into the locker room in the first place?
I was invited to serve as something we call an honorary coach here by two of my students who were on the women's basketball team a few years ago. They were in my first year seminar. And so that meant that I would have the opportunity to sit with the team near the bench during the game and to listen in to their locker room chats before the game and during halftime. So that's when I first got my glimpse into what was actually going on in the varsity women's basketball locker room here at Drake.
And was that something of a revelation for you?
It was. I had experienced a number of the women on the team in the classroom, and I had found a number of them to be engaged and thoughtful students. One of them, in fact, who was on the team at that time, became a Rhodes Scholar from Drake. So,
oh, wow.
You know, really, really across the board represented a high caliber of student. And I guess I wasn't sure what to expect when I went into the locker room, but what I found was that a lot of what I hoped to achieve in my classroom was already taking place in the locker room. So on the one hand, it showed me why the students who I dealt with in the classroom who were on varsity teams seemed so well prepared. And on the other hand, it showed me what was possible to achieve in a learning situation, in a learning environment, that I didn't feel like I was quite achieving in my classrooms.
So let's get a little specific. Are we talking about a level of engagement, or are we talking about some sort of actual strategy that you brought into your curriculum as a professor of English?
Well, the first thing that I noticed, I think, was the level of engagement. In contrast to the clips that you played at the beginning of this segment, the players didn't really depend on the coach to be the person who provided inspiration, who provided dedication, who made collaboration a requirement. They were really much more self-directed, I think, than the players and coaches we often see in TV and film. They were able to take the lead in discussing what was an appropriate strategy given the team they were playing, how to respond to the way that team was playing, how to build on what they had already accomplished during part of the game, how to turn what they had been drilling on in practices into real-time play. And these insights were being generated, by and large, by the players in the locker room. So it wasn't a coach standing in front of them telling them what to do. It was the coach asking leading questions, guiding questions, getting them to think critically about the gameplay ahead. And I feel like that's a contrast, I think, to the image of the inspiring coach, but also in contrast to the image of the expert academic who stands before a class and sort of
really just lectures at students.
Either lectures or takes a strong hand in getting students to think the way he or she thinks they ought to be thinking.
So let's look at a subject that you might teach, say a unit on Shakespeare. What would you be doing differently after having seen that coaching experience in a very technical way?
The system by which we go about reading Shakespeare, making sense of Shakespeare, writing about Shakespeare, critical interpretation, historical research, and so forth, are not at all natural. These are not dispositions and skills that they practice day in and day out.
No, I sort of find that academia often, it has its own language, it has its own expectations, and going in, you're in some ways expected to sort of pick up on those.
Yeah, almost by osmosis is
right.
The expectation. If you read enough literary criticism, you will get literary criticism somehow. If you read enough Shakespeare, somehow it's just going to dawn on you how to read Shakespeare.
So are you in some ways making a playbook?
So that's exactly what has to happen. At least this is what I learned needs to happen. And I learned it not from that moment in the locker room that I witnessed, but in an interaction I had with an anatomist in our biology department here who had been observing some football games and had noticed how productive and organized and well-run the football practices seemed to be. And when she asked one of the coaches, how is it that the students and the athletes on the field work so productively during practice time, he said, well, we spend a lot of time teaching them the system. And that's when a kind of light bulb went off for me. What is, in fact, the system that I take for granted, that's quite natural to me after years and years of being, you know, a graduate student, a professional academic? What is that system, and how do I make it visible to students? How do I show them how to ask interesting questions about a text, to look for patterns in the way a text represents particular ideas, patterns of metaphor, patterns of just words or phrases, the recurrence of particular characters? And to make that looking for patterns and that search for meaning in those patterns explicit, rather than, as I think I had been doing many times up until then, letting it remain implicit or just trusting my students somehow to pick up on the system and just to absorb it because they're in class, you know, with me for 3 hours a week for 15 weeks.
Well, let's get back to that sense of engagement that you also talked about. I mean, when I think about the difference between academics and athletics, it seems that one of the most obvious divides is a very clear sense of purpose. You know, a team wants to win. That is what they're aiming for. Students, the outcome is a little less black and white. Maybe you're going for grades, you're thinking about your career. It's sort of dispersed over a wider spectrum. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think for students, some of the outcomes in a classroom are quite clear. That is to say that they are working in a system with particular requirements that lead toward particular rewards, an advanced degree, a degree, grades, potentially a job. But that doesn't answer the question for them, why am I reading Shakespeare in order to get this, fulfill this requirement? Why am I writing one-act plays in order to fulfill this requirement? Why am I investigating autobiography or chemistry or any of a number of other topics typically taught in the arts and sciences? And so what we need to do is to get students to understand what's engaging, what's potentially rewarding about doing those particular things in pursuit of their larger goals.
So your program is designed, coaching in the classroom, that is designed to bring academics into the locker room and get a sense of some of these things that you're talking about. Now, do you see this as especially valuable for some disciplines over others?
I think the value is different depending on which discipline one is working in. And for instance, in the laboratory sciences, my sense is that the system is often made quite explicit, that you do have something like a practice and then performance style setup. The scientific method is fronted, it's repeated over and over again across courses in a discipline. On the other hand, in some of the humanities, where the systems by which we do things are sometimes more opaque, they differ from classroom to classroom, from teacher to teacher, discipline to discipline, it might be more important at the outset for an instructor to think in terms of basically building a playbook that lets students in on the methodological, theoretical, practical assumptions that we take for granted. So I think it could be valuable for almost any discipline.
Craig Owens is Associate Professor of English at Drake University, where he co-created the program Coaching in the Classroom. Craig, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Bringing coaching into the classroom is certainly a novel idea, but there are plenty of academic courses that take an unorthodox approach to core subjects like math, science, and literature. Some trendy pop culture-type classes are no doubt designed to boost enrollment, but others are a lot harder than they might sound.
My name is Michael Denon. I teach a course that was originally titled Science of Superheroes. It's now titled Science Facts, Science Fiction. And I teach it at the University of California at Irvine. So pretty much everything superheroes do have to either conform or not conform to physics, depending on how they're presented.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night.
Some of the things they do make sense. You know, Spider-Man's webs are, you know, spider webs. And spider webs are an amazing material, have a lot of great properties, and it gives us a really nice chance talk about material science, springs, elasticity. Other things you look at, you know, you get to the conclusion, well, that, you know, doesn't really make sense. It's hard to imagine, for instance, where the Hulk gains all his excess mass. I'd say about a third to a half of the class is the superhero part. And in that part, what we're really looking at is developing the analytical skills of looking at a situation, knowing that you have a set of rules that apply, in this case physics, and developing the ability to analyze that situation in terms of the rules or the model you're given. We've added two other portions to the class, a sort of math skills section, math as a language, and then there's a section just on how the whole scientific process works.
He'd have to heat the cube to 120 million Kelvin just to break through the Coulomb barrier.
Unless Selvig has figured out how to stabilize the quantum tunneling effect.
Well, if he could do that, he could achieve heavy ion fusion at any reactor on the planet.
Finally, someone who speaks English.
Right now, we just finished up our last section on math, and we closed with a how to model the spread of zombie disease in honor of the Walking Dead. Not quite superheroes, but again, in that science fiction, science fact vein, we brought that into the course this year. Students' reactions vary between being very excited by the course and occasionally disappointed. We've gotten better with our advertising, so we get fewer of the students who think it's just going to be an easy course watching the Avengers. So if you're really there just to watch superheroes, it becomes very obvious quickly that that's not what you're going to get to do, and they drop the course.
That's Professor Michael Denon from the University of California in Irvine discussing his course, The Science of Superheroes, which recently changed its title to Science Fact, Science Fiction to avoid disappointing superhero fans. And we've just scratched the surface of interesting college courses. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from a professor who's teaching a class on my favorite subject, zombies in popular media. I'm going to ask him if he needs a TA. From offbeat course offerings to the NCAA athletes' rights movement, we will be covering all aspects of higher education as part of NHPR's week-long series, A Matter of Degrees. You can find all those stories and more at nhpr.org. I'm Taylor Quimby. Virginia Prescott will be back in the host chair tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2 p.m. on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.